This series was supported by the Pulitzer Center.
I'm really happy to be Gwich'in. I'm proud to be Gwich'in. My people are some of the most amazing humans that ever walked this planet. They survived some of the harshest, coldest winters migrating, and you know, they fought to survive so that I can be here.
Welcome to Threshold. I'm Amy Martin, and this is a four-part series about the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This is Bernadette Dementif, the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee.
I'm actually Gwich'aja Gwich'in. There's different tribes, but we all speak united against any development in the Arctic Refuge coastal plain.
In this third episode in our series, we're focusing on Gwich'in voices. The Gwich'in are part of the Athabascan family of tribes. Their territory spans a huge region of northeast Alaska and northwest Canada. Today, there are 15 small villages scattered across this area, but historically, the Gwich'in didn't live in permanent settlements. They were semi-nomadic. They based their lives on the movements of the caribou herds. Bernadette pulls out a map to show me the shape of the Gwich'in homelands.
As you can see, there's a line right here that's the border. So they stuck the border right in the middle of our ancestral homelands. So half of us are Canadian, half of us are American.
Bernadette grew up in Fort Yukon, Alaska, one of those 15 Gwich'in villages, and she now lives in Fairbanks. The organization she leads, the Gwich'in Steering Committee, has been working to protect the coastal plain since the 1980s. And the relationship between the Gwich'in and the caribou is the foundation of their opposition to drilling.
All our songs, all our stories, everything is based on the caribou herd. I mean, we have a culture, a spiritual connection to these animals.
Bernadette says drilling on the coastal plain is a threat to the Gwich'in because it's a threat to the porcupine caribou herd. The 1002 area, where drilling has been approved, is one of the places the herd depends on to raise their newborn calves.
That's sacred to my people. It's called Iziqwatsan Gwandaigotlit, and that's a sacred place where life begins.
Although the Gwich'in have always hunted a variety of animals, the backbone of their culture is the caribou. In fact, a central Gwich'in story tells of a hunter who traded part of his heart for a caribou heart, so the animals and the people would always be linked together. Alaska is home to 32 different caribou herds, and the porcupine herd, named after the Porcupine River, shares territory with the Gwich'in. At over 200,000 animals, it's one of the biggest herds left, and it has the longest land migration route of any mammal on the planet. It can be more than 1,500 miles round trip. For many Gwich'in people, there's really no distinction between keeping the porcupine herd alive and keeping their culture alive. They're completely intertwined.
Every Gwich'in protects the Arctic Refuge coastal plain. That's our identity. Without that place, we would cease to exist. That is how strong the message is to us.
I'm always uneasy saying all people of any group think or feel a certain way, especially a group that I'm not a part of. But I can tell you that it's really hard to find Gwich'in people who are supportive of oil development on the coastal plain. So this episode is not about diving into the pro versus anti-oil tension. That's not really what's going on here. Instead, we're going to be exploring the backstory. Who are the Gwich'in? What is it like to have such a strong connection to a wild animal? What do we know about how oil development on the coastal plain would affect the caribou? And how are the Gwich'in responding now that oil development has been approved?
We have to stand up against any more destruction to our homelands. This is our home.
I'm on the border of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I'm well above the Arctic Circle. There are people out hunting caribou all around me. It's pretty cool.
I'm now in Arctic Village, a Gwich'in community of around 150 people in northeast Alaska. So far in this series, we've been up on the northern edge of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now we've hopped over the Brooks Range, the mountains that bisect the refuge, and we're on the southern boundary. The refuge officially begins just across the river from Arctic Village. When I was there in August 2017, the porcupine caribou herd was moving through the mountains outside of town.
It really is remarkably beautiful. looking up into the mountains on the edge of the wildlife refuge. If this were in the lower 48, this would be a major tourist destination.
Walking through Arctic Village feels more like walking on a country road than walking through town. And it's obvious that people here still rely heavily on the animals of this region to sustain themselves. Fish are laid out on drying racks next to people's homes, entryways are decorated with antlers, and children have painted tributes to caribou all over the outside wall of the store. And everywhere I went, I found tiny bits of bone and teeth scattered on the ground. This place is so defined by hunting that the bodies of animals have become part of the soil itself.
We are the caribou people. If it wasn't for the caribou, we won't be here today. To take away of who you are and be proud of who you are, that's genocide.
Sarah James has lived in Arctic Village almost her whole life.
My name is Sarah James, and I live in Arctic Village, Alaska. It's called Washenko. That means a creek with a high bank.
Sarah is in her mid-70s, and she wears her long gray hair in a ponytail down her back. As she leads me into her house, we walk by buckets on her porch, holding thick bones that were clearly part of a living animal not too long ago.
I've been cutting meat.
The bones are stripped clean, but still stained red with fresh blood. She says they came from a moose recently shot by a young man in the village.
And he shot at his first bull moose, so he gets to distribute.
Following tradition, she says, he first gave some meat to everyone who helped him in the hunt. Then word went out around the village for everyone to come and get a portion. But the sharing didn't stop there. Sarah divided the meat she'd been given into smaller portions so she could hand more out to others. The first portion went to a visitor to the village.
And then I sending one to my friend. She's not doing good with cancer, and I'm sending one to her, and then I want one to that one elder down here. I found out they were not getting any kind of meat, so I sent it up town.
As we sit down to talk, all of Sarah's tools from this work are still out. Knives, bowls, a bloodstained piece of cardboard laid on top of a low table, and a big rock, which she says she uses to break the bones. Using part of the earth for cleaning the animals they hunt is a Gwich'in value, she says.
And that's another respect for our food.
Sarah has led a fascinating life. In the same room where she's been processing the moose meat, there's a photograph hanging on the wall of her shaking hands with President Clinton. She offers me a cup of tea made from berries she's collected, and as the water heats up, she shows me a whole shelf of books in the back of her house that feature her and her work protecting the refuge. Sarah was born in 1944, the youngest of nine children, and she spent her early childhood living way out in the wilderness, often wearing clothes her mother made for her out of caribou hide. She says she was warm, well-fed, and loved, and she and her siblings had a lot of fun adventures.
You know, I was grew up in a good way, and I know what's ours and what's not. But I got taught very well by my family, my parents, my grandparents, and my sister and brothers.
Sarah says she feels really lucky to have been raised out on the land this way, especially because so much was changing all around the family. When her parents were young, diseases like flu, chickenpox, and TB, brought into the area by Europeans, had swept through the community and killed many Gwich'in people. And many other forms of colonization had begun to intrude as well. Western religion and education, and increasing pressure on the Gwich'in to stop following the caribou herds and instead settle into permanent villages. But this concept of living all year round in one place seemed really strange.
What we know is hunting and fishing, and we had to be out there to do it. And it's hard to stay in one place.
But that was definitely the agenda of the U.S. government. At some point in Sarah's childhood, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began to threaten her parents that their children would be taken away if they didn't send them to school. So when she was 13, Sarah was shipped off to boarding school in Oregon.
And that was strange. Oh, I heard my parents, I mean, they have to let us go to get education. That was pounded into their heads, so they're glad that we're in school, but they need our help at home too, and they miss us too. I heard it used to be a very sad sight in Christmas time when all their kids are not there. You know, I couldn't imagine how it is, because I only have one boy, and he's about 44 right now, but you know, I go crazy just when I don't know if he's okay or not, you know.
After high school, Sarah's parents wanted her to get more formal education, but she was nervous because it seemed like she was going to have to transform herself into a completely different person, starting with her clothes.
Usually the small college are in a white community and nice community, like nice dress, and I don't have money for clothing. So I kind of feel bad. I would never make it there. I never have nylons. And I hate nylons.
Me too.
So and then I had to be among a totally different group of people, different community, all that. I just couldn't do it.
But Sarah heard about another program called Relocation. Several years before, Congress had passed a law called the Indian Relocation Act. This was one piece of an overall assimilation agenda, which was ascendant in the 1950s and 60s. Sarah was told the federal government would pay for some vocational training and later help her get a job if she was willing to move to a city. Sarah looked over her options, and one place leapt out.
And that was San Francisco. I saw San Francisco, that the hippie movement, they were anything. Nobody had to pay attention to my clothing. I could dress the way I want to. And that peace and love and flower and all that sounds good. So I said, San Francisco.
That's awesome. I love it.
And I was scared to death. Too big, man.
She enrolled in business college, where she would learn typing, data entry, and other clerical skills. And she arrived in San Francisco in 1967. If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. The summer of 1967 was dubbed the Summer of Love. Tens of thousands of young people journeyed to San Francisco that year, heeding Timothy Leary's call to turn on, tune in, and drop out. John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas wrote this song for his friend Scott McKenzie, which became an anthem of the times. But there was a lot more going on than love-ins and acid trips. Protests against the Vietnam War were heating up, the civil rights movement was in full swing, and Native Americans around the country began to voice their frustrations and demand change too. In fact, this is one of the great ironies of the Indian Relocation Act. The goal was to assimilate Native people and cut them off from their cultures. But as young indigenous people were increasingly concentrated in cities, they began to share their experiences and ideas, which led to a new wave of Indian pride and indigenous activism. In 1968, the American Indian Movement, or AIM, was founded in Minneapolis, and in San Francisco, young Native people were starting to use the phrase Red Power. Sarah says Native people would come in from across the region, seeking each other out for companionship and political conversation.
And then I started hanging around with San Francisco State College students. And they were talking about Native American rights. And right away, to my interest, I keep hanging around with them. They just started American Indian Law, and they were taking that class. And we just discuss it on the weekend. We hang around. They go back to their college. I go back to my apartment. And, well, anyway, one day I guess they decided to take over the Alcatraz, take the island back.
And you were part of that?
Yeah.
This is the point in the interview when I was like, wait, what? I sat down with Sarah to talk about drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and here I was learning she was a participant in one of the most important direct actions in 20th century Native American history. This is Richard Oakes, one of the leaders of the Alcatraz occupation, recorded by a local news channel.
We, the Native Americans, reclaimed this land known as Alcatraz Island in the name of all American Indians by right of discovery.
Alcatraz is a small island in the San Francisco Bay that indigenous people had lived on or used for more than 10,000 years, most recently the Ohlone.
What's this nation you want to establish out here?
An American Indian nation, comprising of all the tribes, including the Alaskans.
In the 1800s, the U.S. government took over the island, turning it into a military fortress and later a prison. And some of those prisoners were Native Americans, like the 19 Hopi people who were locked up on Alcatraz in 1895 for resisting the forced education of their children. The prison was shut down in 1963, and 6 years later, the students that Sarah was hanging out with in the mission decided to take the island back.
Do you think you have the legal right to claim the island? And why?
Well, you're talking about two different societies now. In my society, or in the Indian society, yes, we do.
We'll pick up the story there after this short break.
Support for Threshold comes from BioLite Energy. BioLite makes gear for life outside, whether it's the backcountry or the backyard. Smokeless fire pits help swap screen time for story time, and rechargeable headlamps light the way for early morning runs or hikes after dark. More products and information are available at BioLiteEnergy.com. That's BioLiteEnergy.com.
Welcome back to Threshold. I'm Amy Martin, and this is the third episode of a special four-part series about the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We're in Arctic Village, Alaska, listening to the story of Gwich'in leader Sarah James. After a childhood in the Alaska wilderness and adolescence in an Oregon boarding school, Sarah was living in San Francisco in the late 1960s, where she got involved with the burgeoning Native American rights movement. In November 1969, the day after a group of activists reclaimed Alcatraz Island as Native territory, Sarah packed her bags and headed to the docks, looking for a ride out to the island.
It was a real small rocking sailboat. I never been in a sailboat in my life, and I'm not the best swimmer. Got on there, I barely hauling on, it was packed full. Inside and outside. I was outside hauling on. All the way over there.
The occupation of Alcatraz lasted for 19 months until June 1971, and it's now considered one of the pivotal moments in the story of Native Americans pushing back against white domination in the United States. At the beginning of the occupation, the students issued a proclamation saying they would pay the U.S. government $24 in glass beads and red cloth for the island, which was more, they pointed out, than what the colonists had paid for the purchase of Manhattan 300 years earlier. I'm going to play a little bit more of Richard Oakes reading the proclamation. And to understand the power of what he's saying here, you need to know that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, part of the Department of the Interior, was the face of the violent paternalism that these students were calling out.
We will give to the inhabitants of this island a portion of that land for their own, to be held in trust by the American Indian government, to be administered by the Bureau of Caucasian Affairs, for as long as the sun shall rise and the rivers go down to the sea. We will further guide the inhabitants in the proper way of living. We will offer them our religion, our education, our life ways, in order to help them achieve our level of civilization and thus raise them and all their white brothers up from their savage and unhappy state. We offer this treaty in good faith and wish to be fair and honorable in our dealings with all white men.
The whole proclamation is definitely worth a read. It's a pretty brilliant political essay in which these young indigenous people turned the tables on white society in a way that couldn't be ignored. And Sarah James was there. But she didn't stay long, because in January 1970, her father died suddenly, and she left for Alaska immediately.
And I never went back because there's no phone, no electricity here, and no way to go back. all that kind of stuff.
So here's Sarah James in 1970. 26 years old, raised in the Alaska wilderness, and swept up into events that were making headlines all around the world. And now, she's suddenly back in Arctic Village. The census that year recorded a population of 85 people. I imagine she might have felt like this was sort of the end of something. But as it turned out, all of this had been training for what was coming next. Sarah had returned home to a state about to be transformed by oil. Up on the coast, the Prudhoe Bay oil field had been discovered, and by the late 1970s, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built. Oil was flowing south to the port of Valdez day and night. In the 1980s, Sarah started hearing that drilling operations might be expanded to the east of Prudhoe, into the calving grounds of the Porcupine Caribou herd.
And so I went to my brother that time. I told my brother, how come they keep telling they're going to do gas and oil development up there? And he said, yeah, oil companies are huge. They're very huge. We can't stop it, you know, just us. It's too huge. I don't think we'll get anywhere with it. Well, we shall see about it. I told him that, you know, and he said, there might be a way. Let's work on it, he said. So I left.
And she got to work.
I was one of the tribal council then. And the tribal council chose me to deal with environment issues.
So Sarah started going to meetings throughout the region, learning about what was going on up on the coast and how it might affect the caribou. She says she definitely wasn't working alone. Lots of folks were involved, including Inupiaq people, who are also concerned about protecting the caribou and their own communities. In 1987, they succeeded in getting the U.S. and Canada to sign an international treaty designed to protect the porcupine caribou herd, and the language of the treaty made it clear that the animals needed to be protected both for their own sake and for the sake of the people who depended on them, both nutritionally and culturally. But the Gwich'in knew the allure of the oil was going to continue to turn the heads of the big companies, and the treaty lacked an enforcement mechanism. By itself, it wasn't enough to prevent drilling on the coastal plain. So members of the new management board started going out to villages and talking to people.
They went to each village and talked to elders, what we should do. And the one elder, Myra Kay, she said, well, when we deal with it back in the day, like back before our first visitor, when there's a threat to our nation, and this is a threat to our nation, they come together as a nation. And then they make decision within less than 4 days. Then that's how they deal with the issue in those days, bow and arrow days. And we should do that. We should call the Gwich'in Nation back together and take it on from then.
Sarah says this idea of bringing the whole Gwich'in Nation together to figure out how to respond to the threat of oil development quickly gained traction among the Gwich'in.
So they called Gwich'in Gather here in Arctic Village, June 5 to 10, 1988.
Gwich'in people from across their home territory started arriving. Sarah says back in what she calls bow and arrow days, the semi-nomadic life of the Gwich'in meant that all of the different subgroups met and mingled frequently. But the colonization process had changed that, and the various Gwich'in bands had become much more separate from each other. At the 1988 gathering, Sarah says they were reminded that they shared a common language and history and common concerns for the future.
And it's just like a rebirth of the nation, the whole... Everybody getting to know each other. There's some graveyard of their relatives here they want to visit.
One Native-owned media organization was allowed to film parts of the event. There were non-Gwich'in people who came to the gathering too. Government officials, representatives from conservation groups, and Sarah says they brought their non-Gwich'in ways of doing things with them.
They came up with an agenda, but when they start the meeting, those elders took over the meetings and said, we don't need this agenda. So they tore up the agenda and said, we'll take it from here.
Whatever plan the outside groups may have had, the elders said, no, thank you. This is our gathering, and we'll do it our way. And almost everything happened in Gwich'in. The video doesn't give names for individual speakers, but it does provide translations. And this man is saying, what will become of our children when the caribou go? The story of the outside groups creating an agenda and the elders promptly tossing it out, I think this is an important detail. One of the meta battles surrounding the fight over drilling in the refuge is who controls the narrative. Are pro-oil groups using some Inupiaq people to advance their agenda? Are conservation groups doing the same with the Gwich'in? But both of those lines of thought give all the agency to white people. In Sarah's narrative, the Gwich'in are the protagonists. They know what they want, and they make it happen. She's not describing some hapless group of people who can easily be manipulated by outsiders.
They know that they're against oil and gas development, but how are we going to do it, you know? What to do? Where are we going to go? How are we going to do it? And then they say, the only way we're going to win is unless we do it in a good way, educate the world in a good way, and make friends, because we can't do it ourselves, it's too huge.
So they wrote a resolution, a short, clear message saying who they were and what they wanted. It says the Gwich'in have a right to continue their way of life and that their culture depends on the caribou. Therefore, oil and gas development should be prohibited in the 1002 area.
And we have in writing with our signatures on it, I think they'll know at least we have one nation of Gwich'in people that are saying no.
At the 1988 gathering, the Gwich'in chose 8 ambassadors to help get that message out to the world. Sarah was one of them. And this was a permanent appointment. This was now her assigned role in the community for the rest of her life. So she picked up that mantle and has never set it down. She's given speeches all over the country. She's traveled to Washington, D.C. countless times to meet with lawmakers and to testify at congressional hearings. And every 2 years since 1988, the Gwich'in have held another gathering. And every 2 years, they've reaffirmed their opposition to drilling on the coastal plain.
They never break what they made decision on at that time, and never have, and it never will.
So that's the message Sarah has been repeating over and over.
Look like we made the right decision back in 1988. We overcame many, many battles because all American out there along with us spoke loud and clear. They don't want a gas and oil development. And I believe it's going to stay that way. I believe we're going to win.
I recorded this conversation in August of 2017. In December of that year, President Trump signed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and the coastal plain was open for oil and gas drilling.
Hey, Gideon!
Welcome back to Threshold. I'm Amy Martin, and this is a special series about the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Hey, Gideon!
I'm in Arctic Village, Alaska, hoping to catch up with Gideon James before he sets off in his canoe to check his fishing nets.
I may very well have literally missed the boat.
Before the break, we heard from Sarah James. Gideon is her brother. I managed to catch him just before he paddled off into the creek that runs through this small village, which is perched on the southern border of the country's biggest wildlife refuge.
Go ahead. Gideon, sit right there.
Okay. That's good with me. I'm glad I get to go.
You know how to swim?
A little bit. Hopefully I won't need those skills.
He expertly maneuvers us out into the calm waters of the creek and paddles us toward a net that he's strung up across it.
There's one. That's a big one.
Big one down there.
Gideon paddles us up close to the net, and I look down into the clear water. He starts to pull the net up.
I feel something.
And soon he's holding a huge northern pike in his hands.
Oh, we got this monster.
It is a monster. Huh?
Monster.
Yeah.
We spent about a half hour pulling fish out of the net.
Holy cow, two together.
And then he paddled the canoe back to the bank. We walked back to his house, each of us carrying a big bucket full of fish. Gideon is a maker and a fixer. In one room of his house, he's repairing a boat motor next to a table where he's making delicate jewelry. A hand-painted sign over his workbench says, "Think patient, don't rush, and understand your work." And another handmade sign with a drawing of a drum on it says, "Save Arctic Refuge." We start talking about drilling in the refuge, and the jolly tone that Gideon had when we were out in the canoe quickly changes.
We don't need to go to the Coastal Plain. We don't need to do that. They think that's progress. That's not progress.
Gideon is opposed to drilling in the refuge for all kinds of reasons. He wants to protect the caribou. He's worried about climate change. And he does not see evidence for the argument that development is really improving the lives of Alaska Native people. He traces that disconnect back to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, the 1971 land claims bill that we talked about a couple of episodes ago.
I studied land claim bill the way it was designed as a ripoff.
When he first heard about ANCSA, Gideon says, he thought it was going to be good for his community and all Indigenous Alaskans, because that's the way the legislation was promoted in places like Arctic Village.
In the early 70s, I believe all the stuff that they were going to say they're going to do, there was a promise of an economic boom and better school and a better health program in Alaska, which never became real.
Gideon says he started to have doubts about ANCSA in the 1980s when he learned an important part of the origin story that wasn't clear to him from the start. And that was that a key motivator for the passage of the bill was the movement of oil.
The government, in order to get a corridor for the oil pipeline, they have to make a settlement with the native first.
To track what Gideon is saying here, you need to know that Indigenous Alaskans had been advocating for some kind of land claim agreement for a long time before ANCSA was passed. But the people in power, who were almost exclusively white, pretty much ignored them until oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay in the late 1960s. Suddenly, a pipeline needed to be built. And Gideon's right. That is what finally spurred lawmakers to clarify Alaska Native land claims. It was to clear the way for oil development. And to sweeten the deal, they made a lot of promises about how life was going to improve for Alaska Native people.
And here, you know, after 40 years, those things are not true. Yeah, those things are not true today.
Gideon raised three boys, and he says one of them was an especially eager student.
And when he graduated from high school, he wants to go to university. And he found out that he doesn't have the level. He doesn't have the standard. It just killed the dream. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's what goes on all over. There's a lot of bright kids in this state. You know, our kids need to receive a good education. They need to have a good health program. They don't got it. They don't have it.
When Gideon says that's what goes on all over, I think he's talking about the big achievement gaps among Alaska students. For instance, in 2019, just 9% of Alaska Native and American Indian 8th graders were scored as proficient in reading in national testing. That's compared to 33% of their white counterparts in the state. So for Gideon, the idea that drilling for more oil is going to lift up Native people in Alaska is almost insulting. They've had 40 years to do that, he says, and it hasn't happened. From his perspective, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge looks like another bad idea in which outsiders reap the rewards and the Gwich'in feel the losses. And that's what climate change looks like to him too.
Yeah, one of the things that's happening is we look out the window right now, you see a bunch of the leaves growing up. It never grew that fast.
It's called Arctic greening, and scientists have been tracking it for decades. As the climate warms, vegetation is growing taller and thicker in many parts of the far north. That's partly why there have been more wildfires in the Arctic in recent years.
It never used to be like that. In permafrost, they're melting, you know. They're melting. You know, you and I know that climate change is happening. And we just can't sit down and talk about it. We need to do something about it. We need to do something about it.
Very sad thing to see. When I grew up here, there's a lot of birds, ducks, ptarmigan, and you know, swallow. You can see a thousand of them around here. And you can hear birds every day.
This is Trimble Gilbert.
Now it's going away. Very sad. There are some birds, few birds around here. But they're pretty quiet. Even robin, springtime robin, when they sing with a clear voice, and their voice even not clear. The way they used to sing, it's their voice has changed. Just like my voice changed, same thing.
Trimble and his wife welcomed me into their cozy home in Arctic Village. And as he and I talked in a back room, I could hear their children and grandchildren stopping by and helping out in the kitchen. Trimble's first language is Gwich'in. He says he learned English in his 20s, and he's dedicated a lot of his life to passing on Gwich'in language and culture to the next generation.
I'm a traditional chief here, and I'm also a minister. I'm elder, and I can say anything I want.
Even in his mid-80s, Trimble radiates strength and also gentleness. It's immediately clear, talking with him, that his thoughts are sourced from a deep place.
A lot of people, they want more to hear about the love and kindness. They're all looking for the good leaders, the one who really talk with good words given out to the nations. That's what I want to hear.
Like Sarah and Gideon, Trimble grew up mostly out on the land, learning all the skills he needed to survive here from his family and community.
I don't think we're poor at the Baskin, but then we got everything we need. The land and water, and we still got a lot of animals to eat. So I feel like we are very rich.
And the foundation of that wealth was and is the caribou.
I grew up with traditional food, and I feel strong. A lot of people told me that too. And when they ate their own food, and they had a lot more energies for the day. Like food is just like medicine for the Athabascan up here. So we know that history about that, and we want to save whatever we got here, like Porcupine Hurt.
I talked with Trimble for more than an hour, and he brought up food and health over and over. He's very concerned about these things because he's witnessed what happens when non-native food replaces traditional diets. Numerous studies on indigenous communities in the Alaskan and Canadian Arctic point to the transition away from traditional food as a source of skyrocketing rates of diabetes, anemia, mental health struggles, and other health problems. Trimble remembers what it was like when everyone ate food they hunted and gathered together as a community from the land and water around them.
I'm talking about very healthy and strong people, kids and all. Very healthy, I remember that.
For the very first season of our show, I reported on the story of the American bison, of how abundant they once were, and how central they were and still are to many indigenous cultures. As Trimble was talking, I remembered hearing Native Americans I interviewed about bison telling me they'd heard their grandparents and great-grandparents saying things almost exactly like what Trimble was saying about the caribou. The near destruction of the bison was part of the genocide of Native American people. And starvation is not only a physical thing. Cultures can be starved out too.
Without that caribou, then I don't know how we're going to survive. It's going to be hard for us.
And there's another aspect of the American bison story that seems relevant here. Long before the bison were nearly exterminated, white people began to eulogize them. In fact, they referred to both the American bison and the American Indian as lost, or vanishing, or disappearing, when there were still hundreds of thousands of wild buffalo out on the landscape, and many tribes still hunting them in traditional ways. Looking back at this time from our present moment, you can see that there was this window when people in power had an awareness of what was being lost and had the opportunity to act, to try to stop the destruction of the bison and the brutal violence against Native people. But for the most part, they didn't take that opportunity.
We're asking for help. We want to continue to keep this land the way it is, this small area. People should understand, and they should support Athabascan people. They are right to stand for their country.
I notice in the paintings on your walls you have a buffalo people. Well, I'm proud to sit in front of you today as a caribou people, as Gwich'in.
This is Dana Tija Tram, chief of the Vontaut Gwich'in First Nation of the Yukon in Canada. This was recorded at a congressional committee hearing on drilling in the refuge in Washington, D.C. in March of 2019.
We have lived in balance with the porcupine caribou herd since before any mark of modern history, and now development threatens to destabilize all of this. I am here today to testify that this development on the coastal plain amounts to the cultural genocide of the entire Gwich'in Nation.
A few weeks after that hearing, I spoke with Dana over the phone when he was back in the Canadian village of Old Crow, which is north of the Arctic Circle, very close to the border with Alaska.
So the story goes is that it is this place, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or as we call it, Ejikwatsan Gwandai Gotlet, the sacred place where life begins. And it is here that we traded half of our heart with half of the caribou's heart. So in this way that we would always be intrinsically tied with one another, to care for one another, and to know where each other are. This is so fundamental to who we are.
Some people on the pro-oil side say the Gwich'in are blowing this whole thing out of proportion, that oil development isn't really a threat to the porcupine herd. They point to pictures of caribou from other herds grazing next to pipelines as evidence that drilling and wildlife habitat can coexist. But even though some caribou can adapt to industrial development, it's clear that these animals prefer habitat with no human disturbance. They thrive in big, wild, cold landscapes.
Every single herd of caribou in Canada is in major decline.
Over the last 20 years, caribou herds across the polar north have faced precipitous declines. They've gone from nearly 5 million animals to just over 2 million. The causes for those declines vary, but there's one species behind them all, us. As we log and mine and drill and build roads further and further north and warm the climate, caribou numbers are quickly going down. And for Dana, that's why it's essential to leave the places the caribou have left undisturbed. Places like the coastal plain of the refuge.
In a time of anthropogenic climate change, when is it going to be enough? And when are we going to start appreciating the natural systems and the animals? Just because nature does not speak English does not mean that it's not speaking. And we strongly hope that the world sees this issue as a mirror and ourselves reflected in it. And it's talking to us about the imbalanced approach that we're taking to a balanced system.
I asked Dana how it felt to be on the Canadian side of the border in December 2017 when the bill passed that opened up the refuge to oil and gas development.
I remember that day very clearly. After a long day in the office, I went home and I watched the video of Donald Trump signing the bill. And as he put his signature to it, and he specifically mentioned opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, I could see my elders, I could see my ancestors. And I could hear the voices of the youth because they are everything. It quite literally broke my heart. And I mourned for our way of life. And I wondered, when will my people be seen as a people? And when will our voice and perspective be respected? But I went through my short time of mourning, which was probably a couple of days, and began picking myself up. And nothing gives me more power than my community coming together towards the positive of these issues. I'm very fortunate to have the guidance of our elders, and along with the mandate of the advocacy and education of protection of these lands, it was also said in the next breath that this must be done in a good way. And even if others choose to be disrespectful, the Gwich'in Nation will not be.
I feel like my home is being attacked. I feel like my children are being attacked.
I'm back in Fairbanks, Alaska now, talking to Bernadette Dementev, the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee.
To me, this is how I look at it. Like, I would walk into your house, sit at your table, and just start going through your cupboards and going and kicking back on your couch, kicking my feet. That's how I feel when they're coming in here and just wanting to rip everything apart. You know, I get angry, but then I have to always remember, I have to go back to what our elders say and do it in a good way.
You probably noticed that a lot of the Gwich'in people I spoke with for this story used that phrase, that they're trying to do things in a good way. When I asked Sarah James what she meant by it, she answered by giving examples. Like with the moose meat, she said, doing it in a good way means you keep expanding the circle of giving outward. You pay attention to the needs of the people around you, and you share what you have. And it's about more than that, too.
None of this belongs to us. None of this belongs to us. We're passing through, and we need to take care of stuff that's given to us. And that is what our elders told us at the gathering. They only told us to go out and educate the world and do it in a good way.
The more Gwich'in people I talked to and the more I heard this phrase, I realized that doing things in a good way is a really deep concept. I'm sure I don't fully understand it, but from what I can gather, it's also about what you value, what your priorities are. It's about showing respect to others and also about respecting yourself and how those two things are interconnected.
My identity is not up for negotiation. My identity is important to me. It may not be important to people, but it's important to me, and I matter. My children matter, and my people matter. We need to be respected. Like, you can't just come into our home and just tell us, you know, oh, I'm sorry, but you're not going to be able to have these animals here no more. You can't just come into somebody's home and do that. And this is our home. We've been here for over 20,000 years. And, you know, my children, this is their birthright. And, you know, I will stand up till my last breath defending my way of life, defending my children's future, and defending my people.
Join us for our final episode in this series, next time on Threshold.
Our reporting was funded by the Pulitzer Center, Montana Public Radio, the Park Foundation, the High Stakes Foundation, Newsmatch, the William H. and Mary Wattis Harris Foundation, and by our listeners. You can support our work and find out more about all three seasons of Threshold at our website, thresholdpodcast.org.
The team behind Threshold includes Angela Swatek, Brooke Artsenyega, Casey Simpson, Eva Kalea, Lynn Liu, and Nick Mott, with help from Michelle Woods, Frank Allen, Hannah Carey, Dan Carreno, Kara Cromwell, Katie DeFusco, Caroline Kurtz, Matt Herlihy, and Rachel Klein. Our music is by Travis Yost.